This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, William Safire, has described himself as a lifelong Republican and a right-wing pundit with four-square opinions on anything you can name. Safire writes a syndicated political column for the New York Times, and for the Times Sunday Magazine, he writes a popular column on language. So Safire can zap politicians not just for their positions, but for how they state those positions. Safire used to be a speechwriter for the Nixon administration. He has two new books out. One is called The First Dissident, and it analyzes the Old Testament book of Job and applies it to contemporary politics. He's edited a new book of great speeches from history called Lend Me Your Ears. With just a little more than a week left before the presidential election, Safire says he's thinking the unthinkable. He might vote Democrat. I asked him if this would be the first time.
Yes, I've been voting grimly Republican all my life, and I'm my 62 now. So this is a tough time for me. I even swallowed and went for Goldwater, although I had worked for Rockefeller in that campaign. But this one, I'm stopping and thinking and saying I'm an undecided voter now.
Now, you say that President Bush's attempts to win the right actually alienated the main body of the party. When did he start to lose you?
Well, I was hopeful that he would get some kind of cap on spending on the domestic side. I am a right winger, and I like to see government, the rate of growth of it reduced. So that was an irritation. But frankly, and I'm a contrarian, that means I run somewhat differently from most people, even those that agree with me. Mostly what turned me off on George Bush was not the economy, which is not as bad as the Democrats would have us believe now, but was his foreign policy. I thought if there was one moment, it came at the end of the Persian Gulf War, when he urged the Kurdish people to revolt. They did, and they got slaughtered, and we did nothing to save them until a few of us were banging our spoons against the high chair and getting all red in the face. And John Sununu in the White House was saying, Safire and the others can write 100 columns, it won't change our policy. But when the television pictures started coming on the screen of this almost biblical exodus of refugees from northern Iraq, trying to run away from the retribution that Saddam was wreaking on them, that came into the American living rooms, and there was a revulsion, and people looked to the White House and said, well, you asked these people to rebel, what are you going to do about it? At that point, he followed public opinion and said, okay, you can't fly above the 36th parallel, and we'll protect the Kurds in the mountains.
Where do you place yourself within the Republican Party? Do you see yourself as being in the mainstream of the party, on the far right of the party?
Certainly in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. I think most Republicans are conservative, but not rigid. I would say the reasonable right. There's a hard right, and a religious right, and a mean-spirited right, and they're not necessarily all the same.
Which parts of the right do you think George Bush affiliated himself with?
Certainly he went for the evangelicals. Now, there's nothing wrong with trying to get the evangelical vote. Jimmy Carter did, Ronald Reagan did, and George Bush has. But in so doing, he accepted a platform with a rigid abortion plank, for example, that not even he subscribes to, and that most Republicans just can't go along with. Well, he says, okay, you know, there's a lot of things in the platform that you don't accept or you don't necessarily run on. But in this day, and with the focus on big issues like that, you don't make deals that way. You don't accept that as a platform.
I guess you think it's a counterproductive deal, too, in the sense that he lost people like you in the party by wooing the far right of the party.
Well, there's a way of doing it. You can say, come along with us, and we're much better than the lefties. And you've got no place else to go, and I'll at least listen to you, and I'll respect you, and but I don't necessarily, you know, I won't pander to you. So that's the way Reagan went about it, and he was able to keep their support. But I think most people on the far right, and I have friends there, and certainly correspondents, they feel that George Bush doesn't really believe what they believe, and that they can tell that he's pandering to them on that.
Why do you think he felt he had to do that?
Well, I go back with Bush a long ways as an observer. I remember I was writing speeches back in 1970 for Spiro T. Agnew. Remember the nattering nabobs of negativism? And
sure do, and that was yours. That was your line.
That he accredited me with that, so I can accept that. And so we were smiting the liberals and hip and thigh with anti-permissiveness and anti-drug culture and all the things that later Tipper Gore and Dan Quayle and a great many others adopted. In other words, that cultural, well, call it dissidence, if you will, that required some articulate social answers. All right, so that was that thrust of that campaign. And we were going into Texas, and I remember Bryce Harlow, the great speechwriter and presidential aide, came back in the plane and said, well, George Bush, our candidate for Senate in Texas, doesn't want us there. It turned out that, okay, we could come into Texas, but only to Amarillo and Lubbock and not to Houston and San Antonio. There was a kind of grudging feeling about it. So I think then we went on to Tennessee, helped the candidate, the Republican candidate there, defeat Al Gore, the father of the present candidate for vice president, who was a liberal. And sure enough, in Texas, probably because he didn't use Agnew well enough or wasn't able to go after the far right using Agnew, George Bush lost to Lloyd Benson in that Senate race. And I think at that point he said, never again. I'll always try to get that far right under my belt. And from a moderate to try to do that, that's a tough stretch.
If you're just joining us, my guest is political columnist William Safire. He has two new books. One is called The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. And the other is a collection of great speeches in history that Safire edited, and it's called Lend Me Your Ears. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated political columnist William Safire, who writes for The New York Times. The Bush campaign gave Bush's former opponent, Pat Buchanan, a prime place at the Republican convention. You used to work with Buchanan when you were both speechwriters in the Nixon administration. Have your opinions of Buchanan changed over the years?
We've grown apart. We're still friends. We disagree about a whole lot of things, but we agree about a bunch of things. We can talk to each other. I don't like his brand of nativist conservatism, and he probably thinks I'm a Me Too Democrat and a wishy-washy conservative. That's a legitimate difference of opinion between a couple of old speechwriters.
Did you think he went too far at the convention?
Oh, I think he really took Bush over the side. I think he got up there, and by being loyal, by saying, we're for Bush, and he's for our platform, and he's for our law and order, and he's for our this and that, most Americans and most Republicans watching that and watching Pat be tough and hard-hitting and a little bit mean and bullying, I think... said that's not our kind of republicanism. And if that's what George Bush represents, then that's not my party. I think our Houston convention was a disaster. I think James Baker, who came aboard just about that time, a little bit late, deserves great criticism for letting that happen.
So to sum up something that you're saying about Bush, you think that Bush in I'll use the word pandering to the far right, alienated the mainstream of the party, but the far right doesn't quite trust him either because they know that that's not where his heart really lies.
That's a fair statement.
No,
I'm not a Clinton man.
Right. Yeah. What are your reservations about Clinton? Obviously, obviously you have plenty of them.
Yeah. I sound kind of like a nattering nabob of negativism here. And I wish I had somebody to be more for. But that's what's the anguishing thing about this election.
Well, I can't see you somehow. You know how all the networks had their panels of undecided people after the debate? Did you imagine yourself on one of those panels?
I've never been undecided. I'm not undecided about anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm of two minds about the word ambivalent. I like to take four square issues on, you know, you name it, I'll come up with an issue, with a position. But on this one, I've been finessed out of my position.
These occurred to me, you really have a position, but you don't want to say it publicly yet.
You mean you think I'm misleading you?
Oh, did I say that? Well, let's get back to your reservations about Clinton.
Well, I do think he's a tax and spend liberal in a centrist mask. And when George Bush says this guy's going to raise your taxes, I think Bush is 100% right. He will raise taxes. I'm a language maven, and I hear Clinton say we're going to invest. Invest means spend. It's a word that he doesn't want to use, spend. So he talks about investing. But essentially, he's talking about pump priming. He's talking about trying to get out of the recession by the traditional method of fiscal policy, which means spending more money, spend your way out. And I think at this point, we can't afford to do that.
But
nor can we afford a middle-class tax cut, which he's talking about.
Just in terms of the linguistics, I mean, there is a difference between spending and investing. Investing implies that your money will have a payoff, either in more money or in other kind of valuable, measurable ways.
Gee, I don't think any politician would suggest spending for anything else but that. They don't talk about throwing money away.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about Keynesian economics as putting money into circulation for a good cause. But I think when Clinton talks about we'll only tax the 200,000 and above, that's misleading.
Now, what about Ross Perot? What's your take on him?
I think he's a liar and a bully and a threat to civil liberty.
How is he a threat to civil liberty?
Well, first of all, his penchant for hiring private investigators. I mean, those of us who have been through the Watergate era with Nixon realize that snooping on people and invading their privacy is a terrible mindset. And I think he's got it. I also think he's on an ego trip, and I think he's a poor receptacle for protest.
Now, what are you going to make your final decision on? It's not like you're uneducated about the issues. It's not like, well, if I just learn a little bit more. Yeah, right. So what are you waiting to find out?
Well, one thing is Iraqgate.
Mm-hmm. Which is an issue you've been writing about a long time.
Yeah, and I think essentially that the U.S. built up Saddam Hussein, and mistakenly, and that we thought he would be our linchpin of stability in the Middle East, and we shouldn't bet on a bloody dictator that way. And we did build him up, and he double-crossed us, and as soon as the corruption began to be evident in our loans to him, or our guaranteed of loans to him. Then, instead of cutting it off, the Bush administration proceeded to cover it up and pretend it wasn't there.
Well, if you already believe that the Bush administration built up Saddam Hussein and then covered it up, what are you waiting to find out before you decide who you're going to vote for?
Well, whether or not they'll appoint a special prosecutor. They've been ducking that. And I think this week the president has to confront that issue and direct his attorney general to obey the law and appoint an independent counsel and not a phony counsel the way he is, or a patsy prosecutor, as I put it, to try to cover the thing up.
And if there was an investigation, you'd feel better about voting for Bush?
Yeah, I think if he put it in the hands of a special prosecutor, at least that would be saying, okay, let's have an impartial man come in and take a look at it. And maybe it's been overblown and maybe it's been underblown, but at least that's law and order, and that's a kind of important thing for a conservative. That wouldn't be the only determinant of my vote.
What else?
I like the way the president is being more of a gentleman. In his final few weeks.
More of a gentleman?
Yeah. He's my idea of a gentleman in politics is somebody who slams hard, but above the belt. And I think the way he's done it, especially the last debate, and if he comes out of that and uses that as his way of operating, I like that.
Well, he just said this week that he was talking about the debates, and he said, "Don't believe some crackpot who comes on after the debate who's going to tell you what to think." Is that a kind of gentlemanly language, referring to like the journalists as crackpots?
Crackpot is not all that pejorative, is it? I mean, I think that's kind of mild in politics.
Uh huh.
I want to vote for the Republican, but I'm having a great deal of difficulty because of that foreign policy problem.
It seems right now that a lot of Republicans are kind of fighting in public while the Democrats have closed ranks. And isn't it usually the other way around?
Yes. The Democrats have learned ever since the McGovern days that you have to win, then you have to fight. And I think what we'll see if there is a Clinton administration, we'll see all these guys who have been out of power for low these 12 years and desperate to get back in, all the old Carter crowd, coming in and saying, okay, we want a dovish foreign policy and we want a aggressively liberal social agenda. And the guys who directed the Clinton campaign, and Clinton himself, said that, that's not the way we won. We won talking centrism, and we're talking moderation and all things. But then they'll say, look, we're in, and now let's go liberal, and because we're, after all, we have to stand for something.
So you think the infighting would happen after the election for the Democrats?
Yes, and there'll be a split. It always happens.
Would it change your identity at all if you voted for Clinton in the election?
Well, it would upset me. It would cause something called cognitive dissonance
in
my head. And I would immediately feel called upon to hold him to very high standards very quickly. And the honeymoon would be over in a hurry. But yes, I feel awkward about it.
Now, how do you feel about even talking this way in public? Are you alienating a lot of friends and colleagues?
Oh, no, I don't worry about that. Frankly, a lot of... where is there a Charlie Krauthammer or a George Will or leading political pundit right-wing voices coming out strongly saying, let's all get behind George Bush? There's a paucity of that. It's a remarkable thing. And it's not because all of us are loath to get into a good scrap. It's just that I don't speak for the others. I speak strictly for myself. I think we feel kind of abandoned, so we'll abandon too, maybe.
Mm-hmm. This feels unprecedented to you? This lack of enthusiasm for the Republican candidate?
Well, let's see. Back in the Nixon era, there were Nixon people. I mean, he had a solid core of loyalists. And even in the worst days, there were 35% to 40% of the people who stuck with him. And he was controversial, and liberals hated his guts, and he hated him right back. But he had his loyalists. Same thing with Kennedy. You could always find Kennedy loyalists to stick up for Kennedy even after Camelot came apart. But Bush loyalists, much fewer and far between.
If a Democratic administration is elected, if Bill Clinton wins, would that be good or bad for your place in the world as a conservative political columnist?
Well, I survived the Carter administration, and I tell you the truth, I kind of enjoyed it. And I got a Pulitzer during it. And I was able to quickly focus on the mishaps and the hypocrisies in it. And if the Clinton administration strays from its pronounced principles, you'll hear from me.
But you've got them elected already.
I said if, well...
Right, you said right, if they stray, right, not right. If they get elected.
You've caught me out, and I would have to say if you were betting now, you'd have to bet on them. But it ain't over till it's over, to use the favorite cliche of this campaign.
You can't possibly answer it in a minute, but do you think you were born conservative, or was there something like really big in your life that changed you?
I was about 19 or 20, and somebody said, how'd you like to work on the Eisenhower-Madison Square Garden rally? And gee, I was, that was a lot of fun. And I plunged in, and that got me into politics. And my mindset, my headset was with Republicans. Had somebody given me the opportunity with Stevenson, I would imagine I would have been exposed to that. I like to think that now that I'm a little more mature, I would have thought it through. But when you're getting in early, you get in where the getting's good.
Well, it wasn't a statement of undying passion for a cause that you just made.
I'm a conservative now because I think about it.
William Safire is the author of the new book, The First Dissident, The Book of Job in Today's Politics. He edited the new book, Lend Me Your Ears, Great Speeches in History. Safire will be back with us in the second part of our show to talk about speech writing and political rhetoric. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.